to go down to some warehouse or printing plant and smack some heads together. One night he came in with his right hand busted up terribly, the knuckles pushed back nearly to his wrist, and a bone jutting horribly through the skin. "Dude," I said, "you should go to the hospital for that." He just smiled and ordered around for the house, then a dozen oysters and some shrimp with that, and ended up drinking and dancing and partying until closing time, waving his bloody hand around like a merit badge. His pal James, who'd worn the same fatigue jacket he'd worn in Vietnam 15 years earlier, liked to hang out by my shellfish bar telling stories. James was a West Village celebrity, never, to anyone's knowledge, having paid for a drink. He lived off the generosity of others, throwing a well-attended rent party once a month so he could pay for the curtained-off illegal cellar cubicle he called home. James carried a mysterious stainless steel attaché case with him wherever he went, hinting that it contained the great American novel, the nuclear codes, unlimited firepower. I suspected it was a few tattered copies of Penthouse and maybe a change of socks, but smelling James, I was less sure about the socks. He was a bright, sweet, apparently educated guy from a military family. He'd been 86 from half the bars in the village, but the place I worked put up with him as long as the customers were willing to endure him. I admired his survival skills, his longevity, his staying power. He certainly didn't get by on his looks. He just learned how to hustle, instinctively. He didn't do it in a calculating way. He just did what was necessary to stay alive. I saw myself becoming like him, and I didn't like it. Okay, I wasn't cashing drinks for a living, listening to a bunch of drunks in return for the occasional freebie, or throwing rent parties. I did have a job, and an apartment, and a girlfriend who still, it appeared, loved me. But there was little good happening in my life. I was living paycheck to paycheck. My apartment was a dark, dusty cavern with paint peeling off the ceilings. Though I was no longer getting high at work, my off hours were still revolving around the acquiring and doing of controlled substances, even if they weren't heroin. I was barely a cook. My culinary education, my early food epiphanies, the tastes and textures and experiences of my childhood in France and my rather privileged high school and college years were of little use to me behind a shellfish bar. Something had to change. I had to get it together. I'd been the culinary equivalent of the Flying Dutchman too long, living a half-life with no future in mind, just oozing from sensation to sensation. I was a disgrace, a disappointment to friends and family and myself. And the drugs and the booze no longer chased that disappointment away. I could no longer bear even to pick up the phone. I just listened to the answering machine, afraid or unwilling to pick up. The plaintive entreaties of the caller in annoyance. If they had good news, it would simply make me envious and unhappy. If they had bad news, I was the last guy in the world who could help. Whatever I had to say to anybody would have been inappropriate. I was in hiding, in a deep dark hole, and it was dawning on me as I cracked my oysters and opened clams and spooned cocktail sauce in a ramekins that it was time, really time, to try to climb out. What I know about meat. An episode from the wilderness years. Things were not going well. It was August, and my tree from the previous year's Christmas still lay in a heap of brown dead pine needles in my dark, unused dining room. I was ashamed to take it out to the trash, not wanting my neighbors to see how far I'd fallen, how utterly paralyzed I'd become by my years of excess. Eventually, my wife and I would make a heroic effort to dispose of the incriminating object, chopping it up like a dead body and stuffing it in plastic bags before lugging it in the dead of night a few floors down and leaving it near a known coke dealer's doorway. Let him take the rap, we figured. My unemployment was running out, and the responses to the resumes I'd sent out inevitably invited me to meet with such a transparently doomed bunch of chuckleheads that even I, the seasoned carrion feeder, couldn't stomach the prospect of working for them. There was a guy planning a Marla Maples restaurant. Marla would sing in the upstairs cocktail lounge, he confided, ensuring hordes of high-spending gourmets. The feng shui advisor was writing a cosmic groove around the half-completed restaurant when I arrived for the interview, boding poorly for the man's prospects. I deliberately tanked the interview. Another well-known New York restaurateur summoned me to a series of highly secret meetings to discuss the changeover of his current operation, an unbelievably loud, grotesque, television-themed monstrosity into a fine French bistro. I took the job, sight unseen, on the strength of his reputation, a generous money offer, and the prospect of serving fine French food, which he knew quite a bit about. But one night in that place was more than I could take. Squealing children shoved up against the expediter as they lined up to buy lunchboxes, gummy bears, T-shirts, and bomber jackets from the merchandising concession. Waiters with microphones urged customers to name that TV show as the theme music from Green Acres and Petticoat Junction blared over Volkswagen-sized speakers. The food was what you might expect to find on Air Uganda, tourist class. Boil-in-the-bag veggie burgers, pre-cooked bacon slices, greasy meat patties which were pre-seared and left to marinate in grease in the steam cabinet. It was soul-destroying, and at the end of the night I scrawled a quick note to the owner, something along the lines of, "I could never last even another 10 minutes in this shithole. I don't care if you're turning the joint into Lutece. It is too horrible now." A couple of 70s survivors wanted me for a new seafood restaurant on the Upper East Side, but when I called my connection at a reputable fish wholesaler to tell him I was thinking of taking the job, he groaned out loud. Those guys are deadbeats of the month every fucking month. There are other places on COD, and I hear the paychecks are bouncing like Schwarzenegger's tits. I thanked him for the information and politely declined further discussions. I was utterly depressed. I lay in bed all day, immobilized by guilt, fear, shame, and regret, my ashtrays overflowing with butts, unpaid bills stacked everywhere, dirty clothes heaped in the corners. At night I lay awake with heart palpitations, terrors, bouts of self-loathing so powerful that only the thought of diving through my sixth-floor window on a Riverside Drive gave me any comfort and allowed me to lull myself into a resigned sleep. Finally, I landed an interview that sounded promising. It was a steakhouse on Park Avenue with a large business clientele, a respectable 24 from the Zagat Guide, and a well-thought-of outpost in the Hamptons. They served top-quality dry-aged steaks, manly portions of seafood, oversized martinis and single malt scotches, and had the inevitable cigar room. As I cabbed downtown, I was confident that A, this place would not be an embarrassment to work at, and B, I could run a steakhouse kitchen standing on my head. In 15 years, I had learned everything there was to know about beef, pork, veal, about grilling, roasting. It was easy, the kind of simple, honest food I could put my mark on without working up too much of a sweat. The specials, for one, could be easily upgraded. Steakhouses were notoriously lax in their specials and seafood offerings. There was plenty about this place I could improve. I was sure of it. Typically, I arrived about a half hour early for the interview. Nervous and thirsty, I decided to take the edge off with a pint. I tend to overanalyze questions during the interview process to answer too wise-ass, and these were not qualities one seeks in a chef. So I figured a pint would dumb me down a little, relax me. I ducked into an inviting-looking working man's pub. Irish bartender, bowls of stale pretzels on the bar, Van Morrison on the jukebox. After a couple of sips, I felt perfectly at home with the daytime drinker crowd and the stale beer stink. I sipped and smoked, looked longingly at a plate of chicken wings a couple of stools down. I couldn't eat before the interview, I reminded myself. I didn't want a big hunk of chicken in my teeth while a potential new boss grilled me about my less-than-brilliant career. As the hour approached, I yearned to just blow off the interview, stay here all day, drop a few quarters in the jukebox, play Steppenwolf's Magic Carpet Ride, and have a few more Bass Ales. It would be so nice, I mused, to get paid for this, $1,200 a week to hang out in the fading daylight of Irish bars, instead of having to go through the full mind-body press of taking on a new kitchen. But I needed the money. I needed the work. I needed to get back in the game. When I walked out into the sweltering mid-August afternoon, I was about as loose and ready as I was ever going to be. The place was done up with the usual dark wood walls and historical prints of horses, old New York, handlebar mustache ballplayers, and clubby accoutrements. It was between lunch and dinner service, and the dining room was empty except for a frosty-haired man with a well-trimmed beard in the casual clothes of, say, owner, and a younger man in a business suit. They were interviewing another candidate, a stack of resumes in front of them. A bushy-browed maitre d' ushered me to a bar where I recognized immediately that this was a cattle call. A full bar of serious-looking chef candidates and civilian mufti sat drinking club sodas while they waited. Most were as badly dressed as I was, looking broken and defeated as they stared into space, sallow skin from years under fluorescent kitchen lighting. We ignored each other and tried to look as if we didn't need this job. My fellow chefs looked like sub-commanders on shore leave, I thought, nervously fiddling with swizzle sticks and tearing at their bar napkins, unwilling to smoke at interviews. I gave my name to an indifferent bartender who assured me that the boss would be with me soon, and waited, and waited, and waited. It was quite a while, and I was pissed that I, an executive, if recently disgraced, chef, was being made to wait like this, herded into a holding pen, like a waiter. A Frenchman with dark circles under his eyes and bad burns on his hands read soccer scores next to me. Down the bar, the other chefs pretended they were customers, pretended they weren't the type to wait compliantly in line for an interview at a steakhouse. I drew strength from their misery. A lone civilian stopped in for a quick midday maintenance cocktail, answering the bartender's "How are ya?" with an entirely too chipper for my taste account of vacation in Aruba, a golfing trip to New Mexico, a mention of the comparative merits of the Beamer versus the Mercedes coupe. Then he answered his ringing cell phone with a dirty joke. I couldn't help eavesdropping, and then, in an awful epiphany, saw that all the other chefs were listening in, too. Wistful expressions on their faces as they perhaps imagined, like me, what it was like to take vacations, own a car, combine a little golf with business. I felt myself sinking into a dark funk. Finally, my name was called. I straightened my 10-year-old jacket, ran a hand through moose-stiffened hair, and strode confidently to the interview table. Firm handshakes all around, and I sat down, looking as crisp and cool as an ex-junkie skell with a culinary degree could look. Initially, the interview went well. The owner, an affable Scot with a thick brogue, handed my resume to his aide-de-camp, an American who immediately smiled with recognition at some of the places I'd worked. "So, Supper Club, how they doing now? You work for Marvin and Elliot," he asked, all smiles now. "Those were crazy times," he reflected, a dreamy look on his face. The guy was letting me know that he, too, had gotten laid a lot back in the 70s and 80s and done a lot of cocaine. We moved on, the American casually inquiring about various periods of my employment history, thankfully missing the fudged parts, the missing months, the long-dead restaurants that I'd helped to bury. "You work with Jimmy S.?" he inquired, chuckling and shaking his head. "He still wear rollerblades in the kitchen?" I nodded, laughed, greatly relieved at this trip down memory lane. Clearly the man had also suffered under Jimmy at one point in his career. We were bonding. "Haven't seen him in years," I replied, separating myself deftly from my one-time mentor as fast as I could. "Ha ha ha." I continued to smile warmly at both owner and the American manager, listened carefully with a serious yet calculatedly pleasant expression on my face as the owner began to fill me in on the history, philosophy, and long-term aspirations for his steakhouse. There were a few questions from each of them, which I knocked down easily. I could see from their expressions that things were going well. I was acing every question. I had all the answers. No matter what they threw at me, I was ready. "What kind of hours would you expect to put in?" I knew that one. "Whatever it takes, I'll put up a pup tent in the kitchen for the first few months. After that, I usually work ten at least, six, seven days, whatever's needed." "What would you say your strengths and weaknesses are?" I'd fielded this one before, neatly handling it with a wry but self-deprecating assessment of my finer qualities. "Why are you leaving your current position?" Snore. I knocked that out of the park, knowing full well that the slag on my most recent employer would not speak well of me. I embarked on an articulate dissertation on honest, straightforward American food. "What kind of positive changes could you bring to the table?" I was doing fine. Every answer brought smiles and nods, the rote answers falling trippingly and amusingly off my tongue. Soon they were all laughing. I larded my account of my hopes for the future with casual references to owner-friendly buzzwords like point of sale, food cost percent, labor intensive, and more bang for the buck. Careful to slowly, almost accidentally reveal that I was a serious, experienced chef, a reasonable man, good-tempered, reliable, the sort of guy a 55-year-old Scottish steakhouse owner could talk to, spend time with, a realist, a journeyman professional without airs, illusion, or pretense. I finished a sentence and smiled at the two men, pleased with myself at how things had gone so far. When boss man asked how much money I was looking for, I took a chance, said $85,000 plus family health plan. I was a happily married man after all, and the guy didn't blink. He just jotted the number down on the corner of my resume with a sharpened pencil and said, "That's doable." I kept the conversation moving, more than anything else trying to avoid the obvious, that sure, goddamn right I could do the job. I could train a schnauzer to knock out a few hundred broiled steaks a day, wrap a few spuds in foil, and make flowery clam chowder for customers who smoke cigars while I ate. This gig would be ridiculously easy for me, practically free money. I didn't say this, of course. That wouldn't be good. I was closing in on the position. I could feel it. I cleverly volunteered that my personal approach to cuisine was appreciation of fine ingredients, the too much frou-frou on the plates, food too sculpted, excessively garnished like that of many of my peers, was a distraction. Owners usually like this rap, and by saying it I had inoculated myself against the "I'm too good for this place" issue. Oh yeah, I assured them, all those squeeze bottle Jackson Pollock designs on plates, the carved veggies and the frizzled this and that's, they detracted from the natural beauty of fine ingredients, a time-consuming and costly indulgence that satisfied only the chef's ego. "Good food, honestly prepared," I repeated, "doesn't need that silliness. If the ingredients are the best and they're prepared conscientiously, you don't need it." My tone implying that there was something less than masculine, even gay, about dressing a hunk of meat up like a goddamn birthday cake. This was going down very well, until suddenly things took a strange and confusing turn. The owner leaned in close and with unexpected gravity lowered his voice and asked what was clearly the big question. His blue eyes searched the inner recesses of my skull as he asked it, his thick brogue and a passing delivery truck obscuring the words. I didn't hear. I asked the man to repeat the question, suddenly thrown completely off my game. I listened intently this time, feeling suddenly at a disadvantage, not wanting this guy to think I was hard of hearing, or worse, having trouble with his accent. "I'm sorry," I said, "what was that?" "I asked," said the owner, slightly irritated, "what do you know about me?" This was a tough one. The man had seemed strictly business the whole time so far. What kind of an answer was he looking for? How did he expect his future chef to answer such a question, "what do you know about me?" Did he want his ass kissed, I wondered? Was he looking for something along the lines of, "Oh, yes, of course I've heard about you. How could I not? Why, every schoolboy in America is aware of your heroic trip from Scotland in steerage, your resolute climb up the ladder, how you worked your way up from piss boy to magnate and created this fine, fine steakhouse where the food is legendarily good. Why, I've got your bio tattooed on my chest, as a matter of fact. You're an inspiration, I tell you, a childhood fucking role model. Was this what he was looking for? I thought not. It couldn't be that. I had to think fast. What could this guy want? Maybe it was just the seriousness of the enterprise he wanted acknowledged. Something like, sure, I've heard of you, that you're a no-nonsense stand-up guy, a man who works his people hard, expects a lot from them, that you've been fucked over by bullshit artist chefs early in your career, and you're unlikely to allow that to happen again, that you clawed your way to the top over the broken skulls and shattered limbs of your competitors. Was that what he wanted? Or I wondered shrewdly, did he want to see if the applicant had any balls on him? Oh, yeah, the right answer there might be. Everybody says you're a miserable, Machiavellian, cold-blooded rat bastard with a million enemies and balls the size of cassava melons, but I also hear you're fair. Maybe that was it. Fact was, though, I'd never heard of this guy before walking in the door. Not a thing. Sure, he's got a 24 in Zagat's, but that was about it. It was all I knew of the man. To lie. To flatter now. When everything was going so well, it could be a fatal mistake. So I decided to take a shot at the truth. Proudly, with what I later realized must have seemed to be nearly idiotic pride, I answered the "what do you know about me" question with complete honesty. I stared back into the owner's eyes, smiled, and with forceful determination and complete candor answered as breezily as I could, considering my heart was pounding in my chest. "Next to nothing," I said. It was not the answer he was looking for. Both owner and manager gave me tight, shocked smiles. They might have been impressed with my balls, but this was clearly outweighed by an instant appreciation that I was not going to be the next chef, nor would I ever be. I got it wrong somehow. Oh, they laughed. They were even amused. A little too amused, I thought, as they tidied up the stack of resumes, signaling the interview was over. In what seemed like seconds, I was being politely, if quickly, escorted to the door, being handed the pro forma kiss-off of, "We have other candidates to interview before we make a decision." I was halfway down the block, already in a full flop sweat from the August heat and the ringer these guys had put me through, when I realized my mistake. I groaned out loud, practically bursting into tears at the foolishness of it all, as I realized, exasperated, what this proud Scot had actually asked me. This steakhouse owner, whose end-of-week sales reports probably constituted at least 90% meat sales, hadn't been asking me what I knew about me. He'd asked a more reasonable question for the owner of a very successful steakhouse. He'd asked me, "What do you know about meat?" And I, like some half-crazed, suicidal, idiot savant kamikaze pilot, had asked him to repeat the question, pondered it thoughtfully, and then proudly replied, "Next to nothing." It was not my finest hour. Pinot Noir, Tuscan Interlude. Of all the high-pressure, full mind-body crunches, strange interludes, unexpected twists, and learning experiences in my long and largely undistinguished career, my brief Tuscan interlude with New York's Prince of Restaurant Darkness, Pino Longo, was perhaps the most illuminating, if exhausting. The owner of Coco Pazzo, La Madri, Sapporo de Mare, Il Toscanaccio, and other businesses, Pino was, and remains, one of the most controversial figures in the business, a man envied, feared, despised, emulated, and admired by many who have worked for and with him. I'll flash forward a few weeks into my account to give you a general idea of what the perception of life under Pino was. I was the newest executive chef in Toscorp, Pino's umbrella company, looking as chefly as possible in my brand new Brigard jacket, with my name stitched in appropriate Tuscan blue, standing in the front cocktail area of Pino's newest, Coco Pazzo Teatro, on the ground floor of the swank and stylish Paramount Hotel on West 46th Street. A journalist acquaintance, whom I knew from Vassar, came in with a large party of high cheekbone models and sensitive-looking young men in designer clothes. Startled to see me, he shook my hand and said, "Tony, I didn't know you were working for Pino now." Then he lowered his voice and only half-jokingly added, "I guess this means that in a few months you'll either own your own restaurant or be ground to dust." How did I, a chef with limited Italian experience in my background, a guy who up to now had sneered at Italian food, had even written a book about a young Italian-American chef who'd wanted nothing more than to get away from the red sauce and garlic and Parmesan cheese of his childhood and cook French, and was willing ultimately to betray his own family rather than cook fried calamari, how did I end up as the opening chef of Pino Longo's newest high-profile Tuscan venture? I don't really know. I was enjoying a period of unemployment after the moribund one-fifth had finally succumbed, lying around my dusty apartment watching daytime TV, interrupting my pleasurable torpor occasionally to fax out the occasional resume or two, when my old crony Rob Ruiz, another Bigfoot protege, called me. "Tony, it's Elvis." Bigfoot always called him Elvis. "What are you doing? I'm at La Madri. They need a sous chef. You should get down here right away." "It's Italian," I said. Doesn't matter. Just get down here. Meet the chef. He wants to meet you. Believe me, you'll like it. Now, I like Rob. He's a dyed-in-the-wool, bone-deep, old-school son of a bitch. A guy who knows what's going on in every restaurant in New York, who can call up just about any purveyor in New York and get them to supply his restaurant with free stuff, cheaper stuff, better stuff, and fast. He's a prodigious drinker, a funny guy, and generally he knows a good thing when he sees it. We have a lot of history between us, all of it good. I said, why not? My schedule, after all, was pretty loose, if you don't count Rockford Files reruns at 5 and Simpsons at 7. I managed to find some clean clothes, make myself look presentable, and hurried down to Chelsea. La Madre was, and remains in my opinion, the very best of Pino's many restaurants, a place designed around Pino's love for mama cooking, meaning the Tuscan home cooking of his youth as prepared at home by mothers and grandmothers, coupled with the sort of cold-blooded professional efficiency for which he is justifiably notorious. The chef, Johnny Scupion, was a likable, light-complected Italian who wore his jacket buttoned all the way up with a bone or ivory clasp around a very proper little kerchief. He met with me in his downstairs office, predisposed to like me, I think, by the excellent job that Rob was still doing as his steward and purchaser. What Johnny wanted sounded reasonable. Show up 6 shifts a week, create some lunch specials, make soup, do a little prep, keep an eye on the Ecuadorians, help out on the line as needed, maybe expedite a bit, and one night a week work the sauté station. The money was good, and Johnny impressed me. The kicker was his casual question near the end of our interview, if I was interested in becoming the executive chef at Coco Pazzo Teatro, scheduled to open in a few weeks. I don't want it, he said. I'm too busy. Thus began my crash course in all things Tuscan. A few hours earlier, I'd been lying dazed and hopeless in my unmade bed, wondering whether to take another nap or call out for pizza. Now I was the sous chef at one of the best Italian restaurants in New York, with an inside track, I was assured, to become the executive chef at Pino Longo's latest celebrity-friendly restaurant in the ultra-cool Philippe Starck-designed Schrager-owned hotel. It was a dazzling development. And I was dazzled. Remember, I was not a fan of Italian food. But when I arrived that first day at La Madre, saw that the walk-ins were absolutely empty, saw how tomato sauce, chicken stock, pasta, bread, in short, everything was made fresh, the tomato sauce from fresh seeded peeled tomatoes, I was stunned. Meat, fish, and produce deliveries arrived, and the cooks would fall on them like marauders, yanking out what they needed, frequently right off the truck, so it would be ready for lunch. The quality of food was magnificent. Orders started coming in, and I'd have to run down to the butcher who was cutting meat to order. A short Ecuadorian pasta maker with nubs where 2 fingers had been, rolled garganelli, cut spaghetti alla catara, laid out sheet pasta for ravioli, and punched out fresh gnocchi, which were immediately sent upstairs to be served. On the line, a truly awe-inspiring crew of talented Ecuadorians made focaccia and white truffle oil-filled pizzas, rubbed fresh striped bass and sea salt, filled them with herbs and roasted them until crispy, sliced translucently thin sheets of parma ham and speck, and prepared an amazing array of pasta dishes, yanking the fresh-cooked stuff to order out of 2 simmering pasta cookers, and finishing them in pans from a mise en place of ingredients so vast and well-prepared that I had no idea how they kept them all straight. I never really knew how to cook pasta before. Here, dried pasta was blanched in small undercooked batches and laid out unrinsed and still warm on lightly oiled sheet pans before being finished in sauce a few minutes later. Fresh pasta and thin-cut pasta was cooked to order. Pasta was cooked the right way, meaning the penne, for instance, after saucing, stood up on the plate, in a mound, rather than sliding around on the plate or being left to drown in a bowl. You want to taste the pasta, explained Johnny, not just the sauce. It was, I must admit, a revelation. A simple pasta pomodoro, just about the simplest thing I could think of, pasta and red sauce, suddenly became a thing of real beauty and excitement. All the food was simple, and I don't mean easy or dumb. I mean that for the first time I saw how 3 or 4 ingredients, as long as they are the highest and freshest quality, can be combined in a straightforward way to make a truly excellent and occasionally wondrous product. Homey, peasant dishes like Tuscan bread soup, white bean salad, grilled calamari, baby octopus, tender baby artichokes and olive oil and garlic, a simple sautéed calf's liver with caramelized onions, immediately became inspiring and new. The clean, simple, unassuming integrity of it all was a whole new approach, very different from the sauces and squeeze bottles and exotic ingredients of my recent past. The fear level was not too bad, possibly because Rob was there. He'd call up on speakerphone at odd times and make hideous groaning and slurping and choking sounds over the PA system, and Johnny seemed comfortably expert in navigating the canals and vias of Pino's empire. He was apparently a centurion in good standing, so I felt comfortable under his protection. I was set to meet the man himself in a few days so we could take a sniff of the new chef candidate with the French-sounding name. Wisely, I decided to do my homework. I read Pino's two excellent books, A Tuscan in the Kitchen, much of which was about the opening of La Madre, and Fish Talking, an ode to the tiny, oily little fishes and now-neglected seafood items of his childhood in Italy. I read them with real interest, particularly Fish Talking, which shared in its appreciation of garbage fish an attitude with my earlier mentor, Howard Mitchum. Pino, whatever you might say about the man, clearly adored food, and it came through in his books as well as in his restaurants. At one point in one of his books, Pino discusses his near heartbreak when standing by the antipasti bar at Cocopazzo, when he used to ask some of his regular guests to sample some fresh anchovies or sardines, only to have them decline. His frustration with the difficulty of trying to get his guests to even try something he found so wonderful made an endearing impression on me. I knew, when given an opportunity to cook for the man, what I was going to do. We met at La Madre and went over my resume, thankfully without too much scrutiny. Pino is one of those guys who puts a lot of stock, I think, in his first-hand impressions of character when interviewing a candidate. The meeting went well. I was invited to a taste-off at Mad 61, another Pino operation in the cellar of the Uptown Barney's department store, where presumably I would lead with my best shot, do everything I could to show the man I could cook. My fellow chef candidates and some others already employed by Toscorp, who were aiding and abetting the company-wide drive to come up with a menu for the new store, arrived with the usual, "Look how pretty I can cook stuff." Swordfish tartare with avocado, California-inspired faux Tuscan updates, various ring-molded and squeeze-bottled presentations using expensive ingredients. I picked the cheapest, oiliest, and most unpopular fish I knew, one which I'd always liked and suspected that Pino would like too, the humble bluefish. I grilled it and added a warm potato and chorizo salad topped with a little shaved fennel and red onion with mint and basil, then a braised shoulder of lamb with Sicilian olives, rosemary, and garlic on basil mashed potatoes, as well as a giant raviolone of codfish brandade with crab meat and lobster, just to play it safe. Pino smiled when he saw the bluefish, figuring that if nothing else, I had some balls on me. I got the job. Salary negotiations were brief. Pino asked me how much I wanted. I asked for a lot more than I thought I deserved. He suggested $5,000 less. That was still a number far, far higher than I had ever, or still for that matter, have been paid. After leaving Pino's 59th Street offices, I walked on air over to the Oak Room and treated myself to a martini, my voice still too shaky to speak. When I finally managed to call my wife on the phone, I must have sounded like a breathless young girl. "Dad, you'll never guess, he asked me to marry him." An announcement was made in the New York Times. I was introduced to the company publicist, asked to provide a bio, and my short but memorable adventure on Planet Pino had begun. In a subsequent meeting, and there would be many, as designing the new menu was a painstaking and tortuous affair, was informed that though I would be executive chef, my chef de cuisine, a ferret-like Italian, would fill in the obvious gaps in my knowledge of Tuscan cuisine and provide the sort of street-level, line-cooking, risotto-stirring experience I was lacking. It seemed like a reasonable idea. I could choose my own team of sous-chefs, two would be required, and cooks, but I had better do it fast because Cocopazzo Teatro was set to open in 10 days. In that time, we would need a menu, equipment, and somewhere between 25 and 30 cooks, all of it ready for a celebrity-studded and media-scrutinized soft opening. It was my greatest, most frantic, madcap and mad dash recruiting drive ever. First things first, I called Steven, my perennial sous-chef, but I'll get to him later, and excitedly told him to drop everything, because this was the big one, the biggest break in our careers. Get over here fast, we need some bodies quickly. "Look at this place," I told him, walking him through the rubble of the unfinished restaurant, showing him where the deck ovens and ranges would go, pointing out the tilting brazier, the steam kettle, the pasta machines, the ice cream makers, the butcher station, the storerooms and offices, everything new and of the finest quality. We were given $60,000 to spend in the next few days on pots, pans, blenders, burr mixers, utensils, and toys. And that wasn't counting the heavy equipment, which was already in the pipeline. Stephen responded with his usual speed and skill and became my sous-chef. Alfredo, let's call him, a nice, talented Colombian-American from the supper club, came aboard as second sous. It was a race now. Gianni at La Madre had taken one look at my chef de cuisine, shaken his head and warned, "Watch out for this guy, he'll stab you in the back," making a stabbing gesture as he said it. "What? What's his problem? He's Sicilian?" I asked jokingly, knowing Johnny's preference for all things northern. "Worse," said Johnny. "He's from Naples." I had yet to understand that I was surrounded by blue-eyed northerners, people who felt that even I, though not Italian, was still preferable to someone from the south. Shrewd, conspiratorial, absolutely obsessed with which way the tide was going, by who was in and who was out, and by the daily mood of our leader, some of these characters lived and breathed the kind of existence you'd expect of a Medici. These guys were good. Good at the politics and shifting alliances of a big, essentially Italian business. Good at the kind of stuff I thought I'd always been good at. They were expert at keeping the boss as happy as he needed to be, while at the same time deftly neutralizing potential competitors and detractors. I was in way over my head, and we're not even talking about my relative ignorance of the cuisine. This was a jungle that, however beautiful and exotic, was decidedly not my jungle. Johnny was right about everything, and perhaps I should have listened more carefully. But Pino, and I'm sorry to disappoint his enemies here, was always perfectly correct with me. Charming, straightforward, generous, and truthful. He never said he'd do a thing for me and then failed to do it. I liked the guy, and if I bumped into him today, I'd say so. I liked that he could tell you all about exhaust fans, electrical outlets, point of sale, and the history of pasta. That he knew everybody by name in all of his many restaurants, that he knew about the faulty compressor and the number two freezer in one of them, and that he could list every ingredient of every dish in every restaurant. He was on top of things, if relentlessly so. I had to respect that after working for so many knuckleheads over the years. He was a guy who only a few years earlier had been a busboy, speaking only a few words of English, and now he ran an empire. Not too shabby. Admittedly, the atmosphere around his many functionaries and underlings was paranoid and conspiratorial. Fear, treachery, speculation, supposition, and anticipation permeated the air. The pressure to perform at a high level was enormous. Everyone was very eager to please, the rewards being so potentially enormous and the punishment for failure so sudden and final. My first mission was not only to hire 25 to 30 talented cooks, but to hire more of them than my chef de cuisine did. The idea was to pack my crew with as many loyalists, guys and girls who were answerable personally to me and who could be trusted to watch my back, as I could, before my chef de cuisine overloaded me with his people, folks who wouldn't tell me if my hair was on fire, much less if somebody was waiting in the wings with their knife out. Steven and I raped every kitchen we could think of. We stripped the boathouse clean, lifting practically the whole line in 1 week, convincing many to leave without even giving notice. We pillaged other chefs' kitchens, sniffing around for the disgruntled, the underpaid, the unhappy, the susceptible, and the ambitious. We conducted vast cattle calls, relay interviews, three or four of us at a time simultaneously interviewing herds of applicants who'd answered our newspaper ads. The quality of applicant from these mass gatherings was discouraging. We managed to cull maybe two or three cooks from literally hundreds of illiterate loners, glue-sniffing fry cooks and whack jobs who'd never cooked professionally before. My chef de cuisine, on the other hand, was engaged in a similar recruiting drive and a much better result. From Palio and Torre da Pisa, both excellent Italian restaurants, he was peeling off some really superb Ecuadorian pasta, grill, and sauté cooks, largely people he'd worked with before. All of us were making enemies of many a restaurateur as we bribed, begged, cajoled, and induced people to drop everything and come immediately to work for us. We knew, of course, that many of these cooks wouldn't work out, that we'd actually need more like 40 cooks, figuring that in the first few weeks we'd have to winnow out the losers and still have some extra good ones in holding pattern. It was crazy and exciting and not good for any of our karmic account balances, but this was the big one after all. When I wasn't conducting clandestine meetings in the parking lots of restaurants and smoky Irish bars with potential job applicants or helping out Johnny at La Madre or sorting through truckloads of incoming equipment, I was meeting with Pino and his executive chef at Tuscorp, the warm and wise Martha Pulini, a tiny, talented, 50-ish one-time contessa. We would meet in the kitchen of Mad 61 or in the offices of Tuscorp on 59th Street, fine-tuning the menu, taste-testing, poring over menu copy, and haggling over prices. Originally, the idea was that the Coco Pazzo Teatro menu would be fun and theatrical and described in defiant English on the menu, regardless of its country of origin. Center stations had been constructed in the dining room at Teatro, where food from the kitchen would be finished on futuristic induction burners, carved or taken off the bone if necessary, and presented tableside by rigorously trained and designer-outfitted waitrons. Every week, before and after Coco finally opened, there would be a regular chef's meeting in a conference room at the Tuscorp offices. If I was the last to arrive at a meeting, the conversation would frequently change suddenly from Italian to English. The Coco opening was still a few days away, when, in the middle of a chef's meeting, probably a conversation about whose dry-aged 109 rib was better, De Braga or Master Purveyor's, or whether we could all agree on a single olive oil so we could get a better price, we couldn't, Pino suddenly stuck his head round the door and said ominously, "Anthony, could I see you a minute?" The mood in the room was one of tangible relief. Beads of sweat had sprouted on many a forehead as the other chefs realized what a close call it had been, that it might have been them summoned without warning to the inner sanctum for a private and serious discussion with the ultimate leader. I stood up, puzzled, and left the room to meet in camera with Pino. He led me to his office, closed the door, sat back on his comfortable-looking couch, and threw one leg over the other. "Anthony, do you have any enemies?" he asked. "Huh?" I stammered unintelligently, not having any idea what he could be talking about. "I received a call," he began slowly. Someone who doesn't like you, who saw the Times notice. Have you been stealing sous chefs? No, I don't know, I managed to squeak, my voice constricting with terror. They say, this person says you are stealing sous chefs, that you are a pothead. Who, he mused inquisitively, who could hate you that much? I was completely thrown. I denied flat out stealing any sous chefs, though of course I'd been stealing every goddamn cook and dishwasher I could lay my hands on. Later, much later, I recall during one of the cattle calls, hearing an applicant for a floor job mention her boyfriend was a sous chef, and at a restaurant I knew. The chef there was someone I thought to be an utter prick, and I might have said something about, why don't you have him give me a call? There might have been some inappropriate ex parte communications between my representative, Stephen, and this person, and I later found out that the sous chef in question had simply used our presumed interest in his services to jack up his current chef for a fat and not easily afforded raise. But at the time, all I was thinking in Pino's dimly lit private office was that my great opportunity was slipping away fast, and before I'd even gotten started. I was completely flummoxed, but I did manage to assure Pino truthfully that as far as pot or drugs were concerned, that would never be an issue. We would never have to have that conversation. He waved the matter off, boring in more on who could hate me so much as to find out his private number, take the time and energy to call him up and badmouth me, hoping to torpedo my great opportunity. I couldn't think of anyone. Pino suddenly smiled warmly. He looked, well, pleased. You know, Anthony, he said, I have many, many enemies. It's good sometimes to have enemies, even if you don't know who they are. It means you are important. You must be important, important enough to have an enemy. He clapped me on the back on the way out the door. I was thoroughly charmed, if damn near shattered, by the experience. In the opening weeks at Cocopazza Teatro, I lost 11 pounds. These were not pounds I had to spare. I'm a bony, whippet-thin, gristly, tendony strip of humanity, and after 2 weeks running up and down the steps of Teatro from prep kitchen to a la carte kitchen, like some hyperactive forest ranger always trying to put out brush fires in order to avoid actual conflagrations, I looked as if I'd been breathing pure crack in some VC tiger cage for the last 10 years. I had 25 cooks, plus dishwashers, porters, visiting specialists, moonlighting pasta makers, managers, assistant managers, waiters, runners, and other entities to contend with, deal with, schedule, and replace. The New York Times reviewer had already been in. We had someone who knew her by appearance staked out at the door full-time just to be ready. Celebrities, friends of the house, and Pino himself were all dropping in at all hours. The cooks worked entirely on a call system, no printed-out dupes, and managing the crew alone was a full-time job. My second sous, Alfredo, was already on the verge of cracking under the pressure. They don't respect me, he complained of the Ecuadorian line cooks. Tell them. Tell them I can fire them if I want to. This was not what I was looking for in a sous chef. If the cooks were giving him an attitude, my telling them that the guy could fire him was not going to make them respect him. The fact that Alfredo, alone among all of us, wore a big floppy chef's hat on his head, made all the more ridiculous by his limited height, didn't help. Nor did the fact that he was a rather proud Colombian. The Ecuadorians hated him and razzed him at every opportunity. When he began mulling aloud the possibility that maybe I should just put him back on the line and forget about all this sous chef stuff, I promptly rescheduled him. He ended up bursting into tears and going over my head to the oily general manager begging for his job back. I was appalled at this ultimate betrayal and reluctantly reinstated him, swallowing a poison pill I knew in the end would help kill me. This was a good friend and a good cook, whom I've never hired again. It's a measure of what pressure can do, and did, to both of us. The restaurant itself was beautiful. Randy Gerber's whiskey bar was right next door, the outer space-style lobby of the Paramount could be reached through a side door in the dining room, and the walls were done in Morandi-inspired murals, warm Tuscan colors against blonde, unfinished wood. The waiters dressed like Vatican guards. But the most truly amazing feature of my temporary kingdom was to be found deep in the bowels of the Paramount Hotel, through twisted catacomb-like service passageways adjoining our downstairs prep kitchen. If one squeezed past the linen carts and discarded mattresses and bus trays from the hotel, and followed the waft of cold, dank air to its source, one came upon a truly awe-inspiring sight. The long-forgotten Diamond Horseshoe, Billy Rose's legendary New York nightclub, closed for generations. The space was gigantic, an underground temple of Luxor, one huge, uninterrupted space. The vaulted ceiling was still decorated with Renaissance-style chandeliers and elaborate plasterwork. The original rhinestone apron stage, where Billy Rose's famously Zoftig chorus line once kicked, was still there, and the giant space where the horseshoe-shaped bar once stood was empty, the floorboards torn up. Around the edges of the cavernous chamber were the remnants of private booths and banquettes where Legs Diamond and Damon Runyon and Arnold Rothstein and gangsters, showgirls, floozies, and celebrities, the whole old Broadway demimonde of the Winchell era, used to meet and greet and make deals, place bets, listen to the great singers of the time, and get up to all sorts of glamorous debauchery. The sheer size and the fact that he had to slip through a roughly smashed-in wall to enter the chamber made the visitor feel he was gazing upon ancient Troy for the first time. Upstairs in the real world, however, things were going quickly sour. I was, I'm telling you for the record, unqualified for the job. I was in deep waters and fast-flowing ones at that. The currents could change at any time without warning. One day I attended a chef's committee meeting on the east side and returned to find that the whole menu had been changed back into Italian. This included the listings on the computer, so that when I expedited that evening, I found myself in the unenviable position of having to read off items in Italian, translate them into English in my head, and call them out to my Ecuadorian crew in Spanish. I had to learn some fast mnemonic tricks to keep up, like, I want a lambada just for the halibut, so that I would remember that lambatini was Italian for halibut, or I fuck you in the liver to recall that fegato meant liver. I worked 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, surrounded by a front-of-the-house crew who'd been, for the most part, with the company a long time, and were fiercely dedicated to all things Pinot. They were so gung-ho in their ambitions, or so frightened of failing, that they'd cheerfully drag a knife across your throat if you so much as dropped a fork. The GM was an overgroomed, tall, blonde northern Italian, an unctuous and transparently duplicitous cheerleader who was always urging his terrorized waiters to smile and have fun while he calmly planned their imminent termination. This was a guy who would daily invite me over to the whiskey bar, supposedly to discuss strategy, buy me a drink, and then make repeated overtures about how we were a great team and how we were going to work together against the others, while all along he was doubtlessly dishing me as an alcoholic rube. I suspect that I was providing a valuable service to him on these trips by providing official cover for his own need of strong drink. I soon found myself paralyzed by it all. I was just too tired and too confused and too spiritually empty to move this way or that. There was always something that needed doing and none of it pleasant. Then sudden austerity measures required that I began laying off crew and working line shifts in addition to my other duties, which I was having a hard time with already. Poor Stephen and I were firing people whom only a few weeks earlier we had lured away from good-paying jobs. So many of them that often Stephen would be letting somebody go in one room while I would demolish somebody's life in another. Each firing, each incident, each accident that had to be recorded on an appropriate form for the truly vapid director of human resources, who rambled on earnestly in new-agey patter about self-actualization and job satisfaction and fairness in hiring and appropriate downtime, when she knew that the whole business rested firmly on the backs of a mob of underpaid, overworked, and underfed 10 minutes for chicken leg, penne, and salad every single day, lunch and dinner, Ecuadorans of dubious legal status. Listening to this witless hypocrite ramble on as if we all worked for Ben and Jerry rather than the realpolitik Kissinger-esque Pinot was to dream of smacking her stupid face with a pepper mill, give her something to write about. At one point near the end, Stephen and Alfredo, both reaching the end of their ropes as well, summoned me for a quiet word at a nearby bar, Scruffy Duffy's. "They're going to screw you, man," they said. "You got to do something. You're fucking up. They're going to get you." By this time, I was thoroughly wiped out. "Guys, I know. Believe me, I know. But I'm not prepared to do any better than I'm doing now. I'm going on all 8 cylinders. I'm doing the best I can. And I know I'm going to get fucked sooner or later. When it happens, it happens. I'm not prepared to do anything I'm not doing already. Sorry." When Mad 61 suddenly and unexpectedly closed, supposedly the result of a pissing contest between Pinot and the Barney's owners, the Pressmans, I knew my goose was cooked. More as an academic exercise than out of real interest, I inquired of the reptilian GM and my chef de cuisine what they thought would happen here, now that there were 50 or so long-time loyalists, footloose and fancy-free, and looking for work elsewhere in the company. I knew the answer, of course. I just wanted to see if they lied to my face, and they didn't disappoint me. A bunch of us went out for drinks one night, and I found myself among a party of 8, all of whom knew that of which I had yet to be informed, namely that I would be asked to step down to work with the nauseating and sadistic little creep who was my chef de cuisine. I caught him constantly hitting the Ecuadorans on the shoulder, them not knowing whether to take it as a joke or not, and immediately I offered a bounty of $5 for every time one of them hit him back. The next night, at the end of the shift, the GM had a martini waiting for me at the bar. I knew it was over. He began elegantly couching his words in all sorts of qualifiers, yammering on about redeployment, unfelt and insincere praise for my work, etc. I quickly cut him off. I'd injured my thumb earlier, and in spite of a butterfly closure and 3 layers of bandage, it just wouldn't stop bleeding. Blood drained onto my pants leg as he talked, fell on the floor in big noisy droplets. "Just cut the shit and tell me what you have to," I said. "Am I canned or what?" "No, no, of course not," he said, flashing a mouthful of pearly white teeth at me. "We'd like you to stay on as chef de cuisine." I declined his offer, packed up my stuff, and went immediately home, where I slept nearly without interruption for 3.5 straight days and nights. There is little I miss about the experience at Coco Pazza Teatro. I do miss the food. Strawberries macerated with balsamic vinegar, sugar, and a little mint, Patty Jackson's wonderful watermelon parfait, the incredible focaccia, robiola, and white truffle pizza, the carta de musica flatbread served with sea salt and olive oil, the homemade pasta and freshly made tomato sauces. And I think fondly of Pino. The times I sat at the table with him and some of the other chefs sampling food, each taking a bite and passing to the left. I miss hearing him regale us with stories of his first few years in America, his difficulties and pleasures, and I think fondly of his enthusiasm for food, the food he ate as a little boy in Italy, the squid and octopus and mackerel and sardines, a time and place far from the life he lives now, the sharp-cut suits, cell phones and fancy chauffeur-driven cars, the attendants and the supplicants. Despite all the things that some chefs who've been through Pino's ringer have to say about him, much of it undoubtedly true, I owe him a big one. He taught me to love Italian food, to know it a little. He taught me, by extension, how to cook pasta, really cook pasta, and how to manage 3 or 4 ingredients in a noble, pure, and unaffected way. He also taught me to watch my back better and to make the most of my opportunities. I picked up a slew of recipes and techniques that I use to this day. And I owe him something else for which I am grateful, as I am to my old chef de cuisine, too. I amassed a lot of phone numbers in my brief time at Coco Pazza Teatro and at La Madre, some very fine Ecuadorian talent. The next job I landed, I peeled off some of the best cooks in his organization. They are close pals and valued associates to this day. A day in the life. Thanks to my Bigfoot training, I wake up automatically at 6:05. It's still dark, and I lie in bed in the pitch black for a while smoking, the day's specials and prep lists already coming together in my head. It's Friday, so the weekend orders will be coming in. 25 cases of mesclun, 18 cases of G-Pod 70-count potatoes, 4 whole 4 quarters of lamb, 2 cases of beef tenderloins, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of meat, bones, produce, seafood, dry goods, and dairy. I know it's coming, in the general order in which it will probably arrive, so I'm thinking triage, sorting out in my head what gets done first and by whom and what gets left until later. As I brush my teeth, turn on the shower, swallow my first couple of aspirin of the day, I'm reviewing what's still kicking around in my walk-ins from previous days, what I have to unload, use in specials, merchandise. I hear the coffee grinder going, so Nancy is awake, which leaves me only a few more minutes of undisturbed reflection on food deployment before I have to behave like a civilian for a few minutes. I watch the local news and weather with my wife, noting for professional reasons any major sporting events, commuter traffic, and most important, the weekend weather forecast. Nice crisp weather and no big games, that means we're going to get slammed tonight. That means I won't come crawling home until close to midnight. By now, half watching the tube and half listening to Nancy, I'm fine-tuning the specials in my head. Grill Station will be too busy for any elaborate presentations or a special with too many pans involved, so I need something quick, simple, and easily plated, and something that will be popular with the weekend rubes. The people coming to dinner tonight and Saturday night are different from the ones who eat at my restaurant during the week, and I have to take this into account. Saddle of wild hare stuffed with foie gras is not a good weekend special, for instance. Fish with names unrecognizable to the greater part of the general public won't sell. The weekend is a time for buzzwords, items like shrimp, lobster, T-bone, crab meat, tuna, and swordfish. Fortunately, I've got some hamachi tuna coming in, always a crowd pleaser. As I walk up to Broadway and climb into a taxi, I'm thinking grilled tuna livournaise with roasted potatoes and grilled asparagus for fish special. My overworked grill man can heat the already cooked off spuds and the pre-blanched asparagus on a sizzle platter during service. The tuna will get a quick walk across the grill, so all he has to do is heat the sauce to order. That takes care of fish special. Appetizer special will be cockle steamed with chorizo, leek, tomato, and white wine, a one-pan wonder. My garde-manger man can plate salads, rillettes, ravioli, confit de canard, while the cockle special steams happily away on a back burner. Meat special is problematic. I ran the ever-popular T-bone last week. 2 weeks in a row would threaten the French theme, and I run about a 50% food cost on the massive hunks of expensive beef. Tuna is already coming off the grill, so the meat special has got to go to the sauté station. My sous chef, who's working sauté tonight, will already have an enormous amount of mise en place to contend with, struggling to retrieve all the garnishes and prep from an already crowded lowboy reach-in, just to keep up with the requirements of the regular menu. At any one time, he has to expect and be ready for orders from moule marinière, boudin noir with caramelized apples, navarin of lamb with an appalling array of garnishes, baby carrots, pearled onions, niçoise olives, garlic confit, tomato concassé, fava beans, and chopped fresh herbs. filet au poivre, steak au poivre, steak tartare, calves liver persillé, cassoulet toulousain, magret de moulard with quince and sauce miel, the ridiculously popular mignon de porc, pied cochon, and tonight's special, whatever that's going to be. I've got some play here. Both leg of venison and some whole pheasants are coming in, so I opt for the pheasant. It's a roasted dish, meaning I can par-roast it ahead of time, requiring my sous chef simply to take it off the bone and sling it into the oven to finish, then heat the garnishes and sauce before serving. Easy special, a layup, that should help matters somewhat. By the time I arrive at Layal, I have my ducks pretty much in a row. I'm the first to arrive, as usual, though sometimes my pastry chef surprises me with an early appearance, and the restaurant is dark. Salsa music is playing loudly over the stereo behind the bar for the night porter. I check the reservation book for tonight, see that we already have 80 or so res on the book, then check the previous night's numbers. The maitre d' has already totaled up reservations and walk-ins, and see that we did a very respectable 280 meals, a good portent for my food cost. The more steak freaks I sell, the better the numbers will be. I flip through the manager's log, the notebook where the night manager communicates with the day management, noting customer complaints, repair requirements, employee misbehavior, important phone calls. I see from the log that my grill man called one of the waiters a cocksucker and pounded his fist on his cutting board in a menacing way when five diners waddled into the restaurant at 3 minutes of midnight closing and ordered five côte de bœuf medium well, cooking time 45 minutes. I sip my cardboard-tasting takeout coffee from the deli next door and walk through the kitchen, taking notice of the cleanup job the night porter has done. It looks good. Jaime grins at me from the stairwell. He's dragging down a bag full of sodden linen, says, "Hola, chef." He's covered with grime, his whites almost black from handling dirty, food-smeared kitchen floor mats and hauling hundreds of pounds of garbage out to the street. I follow him down, walk through the still-wet cellar to the office, plop down at my desk, and light my 10th cigarette of the day while I rummage around in my drawer for a meat inventory sheet order form. First thing to do is find out exactly how much cut, fabricated meat I have on hand. If I'm low, I'll need to get the butcher on it early. If I have enough stuff on hand to make it through tonight, I'll still have to get tomorrow's order in soon. The boucherie is very busy at Layal, cutting meat not just for the Park Avenue store, but for our outposts in D.C., Miami, and Tokyo. I kick off my shoes and change into checks, chef's jacket, clogs, and apron. I find my knife kit, jam a thick stack of side towels into it, clip a pen into my jacket sideways so it doesn't fall out when I bend over, and taking a ring of keys from my desk, pop the locks on the dry goods room, walk-in, reach-ins, pastry box, and freezers. I push back the plastic curtains to the refrigerated boucherie, a cool room where the butchers do their cutting, and grab the assistant butcher's boom box from the work table. Knives, towels, radio, clipboard, and keys in hand, I climb the stairmaster back up to the kitchen. I've assembled a pretty good collection of mid-70s New York punk classics on tape. Dead Boys, Richard Hell and the Voidoids, Heartbreakers, Ramones, Television, and so on, which my Mexican grill man enjoys as well. He's a young headbanger fond of Rob Zombie, Marilyn Manson, Rage Against the Machine, so my musical selections don't offend him. I'm emptying the sauté station reach-in when he arrives. Carlos has got a pierced eyebrow, a body by Michelangelo, and considers himself a master soup maker. The first thing he asks me is if I've got snapper bones coming in. I nod. Carlos dearly loves any soup he can jack with Ricard or Pernod, so today's soup de poisson with Rui is a favorite of his. Omar, the garde-manger man, who sports a thick barbed wire tattoo around his upper arm, arrives next, followed quickly by the rest of the Queens residents. Segundo, the vato loco prep centurion, Ramon, the dishwasher, and Janine, the pastry chef. Camilla, the general manager, is last. She walks to work, and we exchange bonjour and comment ça va. Soon everyone is working. Carlos roasting bones for stock, me heating sauces and portioning pavés, filet mignons, pork mignon, duck breasts, and liver. Before 12, I've got to cut and pepper pavés and filets, skin and slice the calf's liver, lug up cassoulet, caramelize apples, blanch baby carrots, make garlic confit, reload grated cheese, onion soup, sea salt, crushed pepper, breadcrumbs, and oils. I've got to come up with a pasta special using what's on hand, make Livournaise sauce for Carlos, make a sauce for the pheasant, and most annoying, make a new batch of Navarin, which will monopolize most of my range top for much of the morning. Somewhere in the middle of this, I have to write up the specials for Camilla to input into the computer and set the prices. At 9:30 sharp, she's going to start buzzing me on the intercom, asking me in her thick French accent if I have le menu. Delivery guys keep interrupting me for signatures, and I don't have nearly as much time as I'd like to check over this stuff. As much as I'd like to push my snout into every fish gill and fondle every vegetable that comes in the door, I can't. There's just not enough time. Fortunately, my purveyors know me as a dangerously unstable and profane rat bastard, so if I don't like what I receive, they know I'll be on the phone later screaming at them to come and pick this shit up. Generally, I get very good product. It's in my purveyor's interest to make me happy. Produce, however, is unusually late. I look at the kitchen clock nervously, not much time left. I have a tasting to conduct at 11:30, a sampler of the day's specials for the floor staff, accompanied by detailed explanations so they don't describe the pheasant as kinda like chicken. The butcher arrives, looking like he woke up under a bridge. I rush downstairs, hot on his heels, to pick up my meat order, a towering stack of milk crates loaded with plastic-wrapped côte de bœuf, entrecôtes, rump steaks, racks of lamb, lamb stew meat, merguez, saucisson de Toulouse, rosette, pork belly, anglais, scraps for meat for tartare, pork tenderloins larded with bacon and garlic, pâtés, rillettes, galantines, and chickens. I sign for it and push the stack around the corner for Segundo to rotate into my stock. Still downstairs, I start loading up milk crates of my own. I try to get everything I need for the day into as few loads as possible, limiting my trips up and down the Stairmaster as much as I can. I have a feeling I'm going to get hit on lunch today, and I'll be up and down those stairs like a jack-in-the-box tonight. So those extra trips make a difference. Into my crates go the pork, the liver, the pavés, fillets, some duck breasts, a bag of fava beans, herbs, and vinegar for sauce. I give Ramon the dishwasher a list of additional supplies for him to haul up. The sauce is to be reduced, the grated cheese, easily recognizable stuff he won't need a translator or a search party to locate. On my station, Sauté, I've got only a 6-burner Garland to work with. There's another range next to it, which is taken up with a bain-marie for sauces and onion soup, and the rest of it with stocks, veal, chicken, lamb, and pork, which will be reducing at a slow simmer all day and into the night. One of my burners during service will be occupied permanently by a pot of water for Omar to dunk ravioli in, leaving me 5 with which to work. Another burner, my right front, will be used mostly by him as well to sauté lardons for frisé salads, to sear tidbits of hanger steak for anglais salad, for sautéing diced potatoes and duck fat for the confit de canard, and the cockles, which will leave me, most likely, with 3 full-time burners with which to prepare a wide range of dishes, any one of which alone could require 2 burners for a single plate. Soon there'll be a choo-choo train of sauté pans lined up waiting for the heat, requiring constant prioritizing. If I get a 6-top, for instance, with an order for, say, 2 orders of magret de moulard, a pork mignon, a cassoulet, a boudin noir, and a pasta, that's 9 sauté pans needed for that table alone. Reducing gastrite, sugar and vinegar, for duck sauce while the dead boys play Sonic Reducer on the boombox, I have to squeeze over for Janine, who melts chocolate over the simmering pasta water. I'm not annoyed much, as she's pretty good about staying out of my way, and I like her. She's an ex-waitress from Queens, and though right out of school, she's hung tough. Already she's endured a leering, pricky French sous chef before my arrival, the usual women-friendly Mexicans, and a manager who seems to take personal delight in making her life miserable. She's never called in sick, never been late, and is learning on the job very nicely. She inventories her own supplies on Saturdays, and as I hate sticky, goopy, sweet-tasting, fruity stuff, this is a great help to me. As I've said before, I greatly admire tough women in busy kitchens. They have, as you might imagine from accounts in this book, a lot to put up with in our deliberately dumb little corner of Hell's Locker Room, and women who can survive and prosper in such a high testosterone universe are all too rare. Janine has dug in well. She's already managed to infuriate the whole floor staff by claiming she inventories the free madeleines we give away with coffee. I'm pleased with her work, making an exception to my usual dim view of pâtissiers. Next to me, Omar, my garde-manger man, is on automatic. I don't even have to look over at his station because I know exactly what he's doing. Loading crocks, making dressing, rubbing down duck legs with sea salt for confit, slowly braising pork bellies for cassoulet, whipping mushroom sabayon for the ravioli de Royen. I rarely have any worries about his end. I smell Pernod, so I know without looking what Carlos is up to, soup de poisson. Segundo is downstairs receiving orders from the front delivery ramp. I hear the bell every few minutes as a few more tons of stuff arrive. He'll have my walk-in opened up like a cardiac patient by now, rotating in the new, winnowing out the old, the ugly, and the science experiments that sometimes lurk forgotten and fuzzy in dark corners, tucked behind the sauces and stocks. He's a mean-looking bastard. The other Mexicans claim he carries a gun, insists that he sniffs thinner and pantura, that he's done a lot of prison time. I don't care if he killed Kennedy. The man is the greatest prep cook I've ever had. How he finds the time and the strength to keep up with deliveries, the nuts and bolts of deep prep like cleaning squid, washing mussels and spinach, dicing tomato, julienning leek, filleting fish, wrapping and deboning pig's feet, crushing peppercorns and so on, and yet still finds time to make me beautiful filament-thin chiffonaded parsley, which he cuts with a full-size butcher's scimitar, is beyond me. The last cook to arrive is our French fry guy. This is a full-time job at Leal, where we're justifiably famous for our frites. Miguel, who looks like a direct descendant of some Aztec king, spends his entire day doing nothing but peeling potatoes, cutting potatoes, blanching potatoes, and then, during service, dropping them into 375-degree peanut oil, tossing them with salt, and stacking the sizzling hot spuds onto plates with his bare hands. I've had to do this a few times, and it requires serious calluses. I hold a waiter's meeting and tasting at 11:30. The new waiter doesn't know what prosciutto is, and my heart sinks. I run down the special, speaking slowly and enunciating each syllable as best I can for the slower, stupider ones. The soup is soup de poisson with rouille. That's a garlic pepper mayonnaise garnish for the newbies. Pasta is linguine with roasted vegetables, garlic, baby artichokes, basil, and extra virgin olive oil. The whole roasted fish of the day is black sea bass. That's not striped bass for our slower students, encrusted with sel de Bretagne.